It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The deadly incurable disease known as black lung affects an epidemic number of former coal miners across the Appalachian region. An NPR and PBS Frontline investigation found that federal regulators knew thousands of workers would contract black lung and that the epidemic could have been prevented. NPR investigative correspondent Howard Berkus led that investigation. He joins us now. Howard, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks for having me on.
Howard, there are regulations on coal mines which are intended to keep miners from breathing in toxic dust. Why didn't those regulations stop these miners from getting ill?
It's because those regulations are focused on coal dust. They're focused on what's called mixed mine dust, coal dust, and what is actually much more lethal, silica dust. But the problem is that the silica dust, which is 20 times more toxic than coal dust alone, is not regulated directly. There's this complicated formula used to limit the exposure to silica dust. And what our investigation shows is that formula didn't work 21,000 times in the last 30 years. That means that there were 21,000 instances in which coal miners working underground and on the surface were exposed to excessive levels of silica, levels that were considered dangerous. And silica is so toxic, and the particles of silica dust that are created when it's cut underground and on the surface are so fine and they're barbed that they're easy to inhale, they lodge in the lungs forever, and then they start doing damage that cannot be undone.
You mentioned the toxicity. Remind us, what is silica dust?
So the silica dust, as it relates to coal mines, is created when miners cut rock with coal. In central Appalachia, the big coal seams are gone. They're mining thinner seams of coal that are embedded in mostly sandstone. And when you might have 18 inches of coal, but the mining machine cuts like 6 feet or more, so you end up taking a lot of rock with that coal. The mining machines cut up the rock really, really fine, and so you have these tiny, tiny, tiny particles of silica dust, and they're also barbed. They're sharp and barbed. So because they're so fine, they're easily inhaled, and because they're sharp and barbed, they get caught in the lungs quite easily. I mean, they're in there forever, basically.
So why didn't regulators take action? Did they really know about it, or did they just sort of look the other way, or what?
So it's a complicated set of circumstances, but the sum of it is that they had all the signs that there was severe disease occurring among coal miners. More than 20 years ago, there were internal memos during the Clinton administration in which the Mine Safety and Health Administration noted clusters of severe disease among coal miners, and they noted that it was caused by silica, exposure to silica, and they warned the mining industry. They had this whole campaign warning the mining industry about this exposure, about the disease that's resulting from it. They even traveled around to coal mines around the country to talk to mining companies about best practices when it came to silica exposure. And the other thing, you know, that we found is we looked at 30 years of data of the kind of testing that occurs underground for coal mine dust. Mine inspectors go into underground mines 4 times a year, surface mines twice a year, and they take samples of the air and they see how much coal dust and how much silica is in the air during these inspections. And that leaves a record. And there's 30 years of, you know, of these tens of thousands, over 130,000 valid samples that have that were tested for silica. And what we found when we looked at those were these excessive exposures, 21,000 exposures that exceeded the health standard for silica, and thousands of other exposures that should not have occurred. And you see that in that data. Well, it's their data. It's data from the agency, so they had it. Now, why they didn't either notice what we noticed or act on what we noticed is not clear. I would say that regulatory agencies are under all kinds of enormous pressure, competing pressures, in this case from the industry, from its parent agency, the Department of Labor, from the White House, the Office of Management and Budget. Each of those entities has their own agenda. They have their own priorities, and they're always pushing the agency to do different things. And we do know that during the Clinton administration, there was an attempt to pay attention to silica, to change the law and the rules that applied to silica regulation in coal mines. And that was part of a much larger effort to reform dust control in mines, which was opposed by the mining industry, and they sued and they won, which that delayed things. And there was also an effort in the House, the Republicans in the House of Representatives were trying to dismantle the agency. So to some degree, they were distracted by these other things that they were dealing with, and that kept silica from being something that was addressed in that time.
Howard, you used the term barbed when describing the silica dust. What does it do to the lungs? The lungs are actually dying, aren't they?
The lung tissue dies. It turns crusty. What happens is the silica particle embeds in the lung. Fibrotic tissue forms. That's the lung's defense, is to fight back against that particle, to try to eject it, which it can't do. So fibrotic tissue forms, and that fibrotic tissue basically becomes useless lung tissue. The tissue dies over time. And I've seen, lungs that are riddled with disease, especially the advanced stage of disease that we're talking about, progressive massive fibrosis. And the lungs look like, burnt paper bags, and they can't function. They can't do what they're supposed to do. They can't they can't make breathing possible. And so over time, miners are having more difficulty breathing. They have more difficulty doing almost anything that we all take for granted in daily life, walking to the mailbox, picking up a grandchild, One pulmonologist we spoke with who has studied this disease for a long time describes it essentially as suffocating while alive.
Mm. Among the people you spoke with was a miner, Danny Smith. He told you he's terrified. Why?
Danny is very sick. He's only, today's actually his birthday. He's 47 today, but he's only 47. He has the worst stage of disease. He has to use oxygen all the time. He can't sleep lying down. He has to sleep sitting up because he can't breathe if he lies down. Just trying to mow his lawn, we were with him. He likes to still do some things, and he'll go out and he'll try to mow his lawn. And after just 15 feet, he has to stop. He keels over and he starts spitting up essentially dead lung tissue, pieces of his lung. Mm. And he's frightened because his father died from black lung, and so he knows what's coming. A lot of the miners who have this disease have seen other relatives, dads, granddads, uncles die from the disease, and it's a horrible death. And he knows what's coming, and he's got a wife and two kids, two daughters, and he worries, what will happen to them when he's gone. And he's already, there's a family cemetery on the property, and he's already picked out, his gravesite, and he's 47. It's really remarkable. And he's an example of one of the big changes that's occurred, and that's a result of this exposure to silica dust. He's a miner who is relatively young. He only worked 12 years underground. And yet he has this worst stage of disease, and he's one of the sickest miners that I've encountered.
We only have less than 2 minutes left. Has there been any response from the government to fix this? And if so, could it happen soon?
Well, there is nothing in the regulatory agenda of the Mine Safety and Health Administration at the moment that directly addresses silica. What is recommended is a limit on the dust exposure that would be twice as tough, and completely separate regulation of silica, getting rid of this formula that has been used all these years that we show didn't work all the time. But there's no action on that. One thing that did happen last night is Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia, who's the incoming chair of the House Workforce Committee, is going to call hearings in the upcoming Congress.
And that's what I was going to ask you. Could Congress step in? Might they be the catalyst for action? About 30 seconds, Howard.
Absolutely. I mean, Congress has some responsibility here as well. The laws could be toughened. There have not been any serious attempts to pass mine safety reform since the Upper Big Branch mine disaster in 2010. That, you know, Congress did not act then. Congress could act, and Congress could make all the difference in the world.
Howard Berkus is an investigative reporter for NPR who partnered with PBS Frontline series to explore the epidemic that is killing coal miners that could have been stopped. You can hear more from Howard, plus longtime miner Charles Shortwage, who has been diagnosed with black lung disease, and David McAteer, former Assistant Secretary of Mine Safety and Health Administration, coming up on 1A with Joshua Johnson at 10 this morning. Howard, thanks so much for joining us today, and thanks for your reporting.
I appreciate your interest.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Mick Stinelli with your Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in Pittsburgh history, the city's first hockey arena burned in 1896. It was the Schenley Park Casino. The complex opened in 1895 with a price tag of $400,000. When it burned, the insurance on the building didn't even cover a quarter of that cost. Though it lived only a year, the casino left behind a legacy. It introduced thousands of Pittsburghers to ice hockey 50 years before the Penguins existed. Now the Frick Fine Arts Building sits on the site where the casino burned. This has been your Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. For many students, college is the first time they're navigating healthcare alone. Universities are making it easier and cheaper to get care on campus. But depending on where you go to school and what your major is, it might not be that simple. 90.5 WESA's Sabrina Bowden reports.
When Jay Salkire was a freshman at Carnegie Mellon University, he slipped and hit his head. He didn't visit a physician immediately, but he was pretty sure he had a concussion. He'd had three before, two from playing hockey and one from a car accident in high school.
I kind of just took some Advil and kept going through my work as best as I could.
Salkire studies architecture. He and other students in the program at CMU say they spend up to 12 hours at a time working on projects. With a midterm coming up, he didn't feel like he had the time to be sick.
Because of how much work we had in all our classes, I knew I couldn't afford not only going to the doctor to get diagnosed, but I guess also taking time to rest.
But he says looking back, if he had sought treatment for his suspected concussion earlier, he would have saved himself a lot of time and frustration.
It definitely could have just been 2 days rest and I could have been back to normal instead of 2 weeks of just trying to keep up with the pace.
Salkire says the main reason he didn't visit a doctor was because he worried his grade would drop from missing class. He says it's frowned upon to stay home when sick or tired. Between balancing assignments, class attendance, and hoping to squeeze in a social life, carving time out for a doctor's appointment isn't a priority for many students in rigorous academic programs.
There's nothing more disappointing to me than having a senior come in and they look around and they say, "Wow, I had no idea that I could have been using this."
Elizabeth Wedick is the medical director at the University of Pittsburgh's health clinic. She says about 1,000 students a week visit for everything from upper respiratory infections to IUD insertions.
I always say that what we try to be is the primary care provider away from home.
Pitt's clinic is open 6 days a week, has evening and weekend hours, and low $5 copays. But navigating the healthcare system can still be confusing. And for young adults who've previously relied on parents to schedule their appointments, it can be downright intimidating. Katie Leslie is a nurse at Point Park University. She says there's an element of hand-holding to assist students in transitioning to being in charge of their own health care. Like Pitt, Point Park is trying to make it as easy as possible for students to access care. The school recently opened an online scheduling portal and walk-in hours to allow flexibility in choosing appointments.
They don't run the risk of walking in and there may be eight people in front of them and they just have to wait. And then they either walk away untreated or they have to wait and miss class.
Some schools even offer low-cost flu shots, access to doctors off campus, and rides to hospitals so students don't incur ambulance fees. Leslie says schools are also trying to destigmatize mental health by offering treatment and resources like therapy and stress management.
We're here not only just for when you're sick or injured, but also, you know, we have resources for health and wellness as well.
But college students in Pittsburgh say whether they have time to go to the doctor has a lot to do with how demanding their coursework is. For example, computer science and engineering students across campuses say they were commonly pulling all-nighters, but language and history students had a little more free time in their schedules. CMU architecture student Jay Saukire says he knows his health is important, but he says the rigorous academic culture doesn't prioritize student wellness.
At least in our major, and especially at CMU, like, school goes a mile a minute. So if you don't go to one class, you're probably easily like hours and possibly days behind other kids.
CMU's architecture program did not respond to requests for comment. Saukire says students regularly come to class and the workshop's sick, spreading whatever they have to other students. When mono went around campus last year, he says it was like the plague. But students were too scared of their grades dropping to stay home and get well. I'm Sabrina Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Haiti was already the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere when an earthquake devastated that country in January 2010. Since then, different groups of humanitarians have traveled to Haiti to pitch in, tell stories, learn about its people and culture, including a rotating group of Pittsburgh journalists. I'm joined in studio by a group who recently returned from an annual trip. Dr. Irvin Dyer is the senior editor in the Office of University Communications at the University of Pittsburgh. Allegra Johnson is a freelance journalist and communications manager at Propel Schools. And Jermaine Watkins is a photography teacher and artist with Manchester Craftsmen's Guild. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Irvin, you were among the first travelers in this group some years ago. You've since been back many times. What made you first want to travel to Haiti, and what did you find when you first arrived?
Wow, so a couple of things, Kevin. I first went at the invitation of a gentleman who runs a local charity here, Functional Literacy Ministry of Haiti, Dr. Leon Pamphile. He's a native Haitian. He created this ministry to help the people in his community with education and health care. So he asked me to come. The second reason I went is I love Langston Hughes, and Langston Hughes had traveled to Haiti. And I wanted to go every place in the world that Langston Hughes had gone. So I went to Haiti, and I found just an incredible experience. Culturally, in the rural areas, it reminded me so much of the experience I had growing up with my grandmother that I found it very welcoming and warm, and I just fell in love with Haiti when I first went.
And you went before, your first trip was actually before the earthquake.
Before the earthquake, exactly right. So I had a chance to see Haiti pre-earthquake and post-earthquake.
So one more to you now, and that is, you went for one reason the first time, but then the second time you say, hold it, I can sort of use my professional skills?
That's exactly right. So the first time I went in sort of mission with Functional Literacy Ministry of Haiti, right, to provide health care and to teach. But my profession was as a journalist. So I said, how can I use what I know best in aid of the Haitian people? And that was storytelling. So we created this sort of mashup kind of mission kind of thing called Storytelling Missions. Mm-hmm. So I began to invite my friends who were journalists, my friends who were sociologists, my friends who were historians to come travel with me to Haiti to tell stories about the Haitian people.
All right, Jermaine, Allegra, have you been there before? Was this your first trip?
This year was my second trip. Last year was my first trip.
Okay, so then let's follow up with you, Jermaine. So what was it about your first trip you said, I want to go back?
Well, with the first trip, Irv invited me to do that. And as a photographer, I wanted to go to some place that I'd never seen before and also to take that experience and allow it to relate to my students. And so with that, I was able to do that on that first year. And then the second year, it was just more like, oh, okay, so what else can I learn from this experience and see and take images of and capture the life and cultures of Haiti and Haitians there? And so whenever I did that, it was just really eye-opening and real profound to see the Haitians as they are. They're awesome people.
Right. Allegra, first trip, or have you been there before?
This year was my first year going to Haiti. Okay. So it was very interesting because, unlike these two gentlemen, it wasn't a trip that I necessarily wanted to go on at first. I wanted to at the invitation of Dr. Dyer, and I had just got back from doing some journalism work in Belgium and Germany. So I was on kind of a travel kick, you know. And when I got to Haiti, it was tough. At first, it was tough, and especially going with a humanitarian organization as I went on the first trip, but part of a storytelling mission, it was very tough. But then I got to see the other side of Haiti, the side that we don't get to see much of, and that's why, that's where my love from Haiti grew.
Yeah, Allegra and Jermaine. Since you've been there fewer times than Irvin, did you go with any assumptions, or did you have sort of a clean slate when you
Okay,
Jermaine.
Well, my first time, I like to cruise, and that's my form of travel that I really love to do. And so whenever I was approached to go to Haiti, I was thinking, oh, okay. I didn't know too much about Haiti and its history and culture and things like that. All I knew was what was recorded in national publications and things like that, where it's really awful and depressing and this and that and the other, negative, negative, negative. And so I got into that mindset, okay, I'm going off and do this like really cool, interesting trip, but it's not going to be a luxury trip. And so I went there, and it was not a luxury trip, but it was luxurious in a way of seeing how people are resilient. And it was just an awesome experience, and that's why I went back the second time.
Allegra, you're nodding.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Jermaine. All of my notions about Haiti, they were negative. Even as I read stories from Dr. Dyer and, you know, heard from my other colleagues about it being this fantastic place. But when I Googled, Google right. doesn't show you,
no.
You know, the great parts of Haiti. But yeah. I'm glad I had a chance to see for myself.
I'm curious because you've been there how many times now?
Seven.
Okay, seven times. Has your perception changed over those years? Obviously, absolutely. Maybe some conditions have changed.
Yes.
You've met additional people, yes. But has your perception changed?
Absolutely. So much like Jermaine and Allegra, my first impression also, I was horrified, right? Because I knew little of Haiti. It's never a place I imagined I would go, so I knew little of the country. And going into my first trip, my family prayed for me. I prayed for myself because we just didn't know what to expect. But part of our mission with the storytelling mission is to break through all of that. Because mm-hmm. once you get to Haiti, you realize that it is an incredible human place, right? Just mm-hmm. like America is human, it is a country of 11 million people. 11 million of those people all have stories. Mm-hmm. So our mission is to tell those stories. And one of the things you referenced when you opened us up to this conversation, whether it's the poorest country in the Western right. Hemisphere, that's mostly all that people know. Mm-hmm. But traveling into Haiti, you begin to quickly understand how flat and one-dimensional that description of Haiti is. Because once you get there and meet some of the 11 million people, a world, a universe that you never expect opens up to you. And that is the world that we try to bring back to America through our storytelling.
Yeah, that might be one of the first descriptions in any of Haiti,
yes.
either the first or shares an island with Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right,
right.
Yeah. Yes.
What I liken it to and what I have written about is the same way if someone from a different country came to America and all they could see was New York City, they would think everyone lived like people in New York, or if they went to the heartland and, you know, seen the rural farmers and things like that, that would be the only perception they had. They wouldn't realize that there is California and there's, you know, Florida and so many different aspects. Same type of thing.
To each of you. Okay. So, yes, fact, poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. But you alluded to that it wasn't the focus, the intention mm-hmm. of your storytelling. But you can't ignore the poverty either.
But it's only poor to us because we know different. Yes. It's a way of right. life to them.
Yeah. You know, it's, they don't know they're poor until you tell them that they're poor.
You're poor. That's
right. You're like, oh, I'm poor? Yeah.
That's right. And what I want to say also about narrative storytelling, right? So we create these narratives, right, that what success looks like. And in America, we understand that to be mostly male and mostly white and mostly wealthy. Mm-hmm. And if you start up with that criteria as your narrative, much of that is not Haiti.
Yeah.
But there are success stories in Haiti. You just mm-hmm. have to look at them differently and report them differently. And that's the mission of what we do, is to understand the context in which they're living. Sure, a lot of that is touched by extreme poverty, but how they respond to those challenges and to that challenge of poverty in terms of taking care of their families, communities, loving each other, having normal lives, that is the narrative that we try to bring back.
All right, so maybe a different definition of success or a perception of success. Give us a sense of what is successful in Haiti for a Haitian.
So I'll take you here. I'll take you to the Successful Institute, right, okay. which is a school that we support. We tell stories about the gentleman who started the school. For Jimmy, who started the school, success for him is having 300 kids in a mountainous community, be able to learn English, right? Because that gives him opportunities for a better life. Mm-hmm. What this means for him is that he doesn't make a lot of money. What it means for him is that a student struggles with tuition, he waives it, mm-hmm. right? So he is never going to be wealthy. So we can't judge his success by the wealth because mm-hmm. that's not what he's after. Mm-hmm. So we have to see what Jimmy is doing in the context of how he's living and what he determines is success for him. What is his motivation and what does he want? And so that's how we look at it.
We're speaking with Dr. Irvin Dyer, Allegra Johnson, and Jermaine Watkins. They were part of a group of journalists who traveled to Haiti this fall, and we're learning about their storytelling mission. First of all, this cannot be an inexpensive venture. Did you get any support?
Yeah, so this year we were supported by the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation, mm-hmm. which has an Edna McKenzie Fellowship. Edna McKenzie was a pioneering female journalist with the Pittsburgh Courier at right. that time. And so we wanted to honor her. And so we applied and got some funding support to help us get there through the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation.
But I will say, going to Haiti is a lot cheaper. It's a lot cheaper than going to, Germany. You know, yes. It is. It's yes. a lot cheaper. So people, and I think that's another thing, sometimes people think, going to a country like Haiti, you know, it's right next door. It's the same country as the DR, but, you know, we don't realize it until you're flying over and you see, like, the lush, beautiful part of the DR. Then you see, you know, desolate trees and everything on the Haitian side. But you don't have to have a lot to go.
Right. There were ties with Pittsburgh and Haiti as a result of that massive 2010 earthquake. Doctors, surgeons, other healthcare providers went down, anybody to help with the victims. And people might remember the sisters from the Pittsburgh area, the McMutry sisters, mm-hmm. who ran an orphanage there. Mm-hmm. And dozens of orphans actually were flown to the Pittsburgh area mm-hmm. to meet up with their prospective adoptive parents. Talk about what connections, did you explore connections already between Pittsburgh and Haiti before you went, or explore them after you came back? I'll start with you, Irv.
Yeah, so largely why we are there is because of the Functional Literacy Ministry of Haiti. When I was working as a journalist at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Dr. Pomfield called me, right? And he simply wanted a brief about the celebration of independence of Haiti. And the more I talked to him, the more I realized how fascinating a gentleman that he was. And so then I found out about his connection to founding this charity, and the charity is what first invited me to Pittsburgh. But his charity is run largely through the support and fundraising of local people in Pittsburgh. Churches and individuals here do a lot of support for his ministry, and it was his ministry that first invited us there. And when we go, we stay at the guest house at that particular ministry.
Mm-hmm. Allegra?
Yeah. There's a huge Pittsburgh connection. I feel like when I traveled there, we traveled with a group of doctors and nurses and medical professionals that were right here in Pittsburgh, dentists and medical professionals, like I said, who donated their time and services to the people of Haiti. But when you go, right. you find, I mean, we've met people from Canada, people from the UK. It's so many people. Everyone wants to bring their love and support to Haiti.
Mm-hmm. To each of you, why is this storytelling mission important to Pittsburgh or anywhere for that matter? Jermaine, I'm going to start with you on this.
It's very important for people to understand that there's people all around the world that are in need of just basic love. And within the Haitian society and Haitian people, there are people that are very lovely people. And to help them and support them is what we should be doing as a whole nation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I think the fact that all stories matter, right? And I think it's especially connected to places like Pittsburgh, where you have such levels of segregation still in this city, and we know the damage that one narrative can do to a community, say Homewood or the Hill District, how those communities tend to be marginalized and pulled apart from the larger American fabric. I think the same thing globally happens to Haiti, right? Mm-hmm. We understand it to be a poor place, and that somehow separates it, makes it less human. And I think those same dynamics are at work in Homewood and the Hill District that we see play out in Haiti. And so what we want to do is say that stories here matter. There are humans here. We want to tell those stories because we're journalists, and all stories matter.
So you're connecting Homewood and Hill with Haiti.
I think some of the economic dynamics and marginalizations that you see in these communities are the same things that are happening to Haiti on a global scale.
I would agree, and I always say that, yes, Haiti is a poor country, it's tough, but other parts of it look like down the street on the south side. It looks like parts of Homewood, the Hill. It was very, very familiar, especially when we were in Port-au-Prince and we were in that park and the kids playing basketball. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw Range Rovers, you know, right. And that blew my mind. Right. Like, there's a Range Rover, you know. But yes, it's no different from our backyard. It's just we have to open our minds and think about that.
Journalists, I believe, will often try to help their readers, their listeners, connect with the central figures of these stories, mm-hmm. or the topics of the stories, beyond the natural empathy we would have in this case for people trying to still overcome that earthquake. Did you try to do that, and how? And Jermaine, we'll start with you. And how do you do that through imagery? How do you do that through your photography?
Well, through imagery, you're just depicting a moment in time. While we were traveling over there, you see a whole bunch of different things. You see beyond just a frame inside your camera. And so you're trying to pick out that decisive moment to portray the best light as possible. And so whenever I'm taking pictures, I want people to see, yes, okay, there are some bad points or what have you, but there also are some really great points over in Haiti where not too many people are able to see that, and there's not a lot of opportunity for that to be shown, and so that's what I want to show.
Mm-hmm. Whether it's through the spoken word or the printed word, Allegra and Irva, how do you do that?
So one of the things that Jermaine did when he came back, he created a wonderful exhibition called Haiti Beyond the Headlines. Mm-hmm. And so I think what happens for us, for me in particular, because I've gone 7 times, is you see beyond the trash, right? And so you begin to see beyond just the surface level of what's there, and you can go deeper into the community, deeper into the culture, to look at sort of cultural conflicts, right, and report on those, to look at how people are measuring success different. You can look at what motivates them to go up a mountain and try to build a school almost from nothing. You know, right. Who does that, and how do you do it? And so once you get there, you're able to look beyond just the trash and images that perhaps may stun you and say, there are human relationships here, and how can we talk about what's going on? And yeah, that's what we try to do.
Even with the images, those images that can shock us, there's even a story behind that. You know, going with photographers like Jermaine and Kay Neely that we went with, a beautiful picture tells 1,000 words. Is that the saying?
Yes.
You know, and it literally does. It's so much more behind the eyes. You look at these pictures of these men and these women and these children, and you can see in their eyes, you know, the wantiness, the willingness and everything. And I think for me, my storytelling is just about that we are more alike than we're different.
That's right. And case in point, really quickly, in Jacmel, right, for instance, there's this wonderful Jacmel Cultural Center. Mm-hmm. On the outside, it was hit by the earthquake, right? So it's crumbling, it's tattered. But inside,
beautiful.
Mm-hmm. The art, the dance, the music, and the culture that's reproduced there, and the way that people relate to each other because they're creating art as storytelling. It's just an amazing, amazing experience about what humans can do. But to look at it from the outside, mm-hmm. you wouldn't think there was much there.
So yeah. the vibrancy wasn't destroyed.
It was not destroyed, right, exactly. Yeah.
Just a couple of minutes left. We can't all go to Haiti and meet with the people.
Why not?
Well, okay. That was the wrong assumption. Okay, not all of us will go to Haiti.
Okay.
So is your storytelling a way for us to share in your experience?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think so. Of course, you know, reading, listening, seeing photographs, it takes you to another world. It transforms you. And that's what I love. I'm a journalist, but I'm also a reader, you know, a listener. I participate both ways in the journalistic efforts. And yeah, definitely. That's what made me want to go, even though I didn't necessarily want to go. But reading your piece, Dr. Dyer's piece on Jacmel and just everything that was there, and it was beyond my expectations.
All right. So you had 20 seconds each. All right. Give me one of your favorite reflections.
Wow. So I for me, it would have to be the mountain community of Kinskoff, because it reminds me so much of my grandmother and staying with her and living with her. And it takes me back to those moments.
Wow. Yeah. Wonderful. Jermaine.
Just being there and seeing all the different variety of landscaping, from desolation to beaches and to very beautiful scenic areas, the mountainside, traveling through the mountainside and seeing those, the sun peeking through the mountain, it was just gorgeous.
I bet you that just really piqued your curiosity as a photographer.
Oh, yes.
Okay, Allegra.
Well, my moment won't take 20 seconds, but I'll do the abbreviated version. So I will say Google everyone, but visiting the Citadel in Cap Haitian, Haiti. A beautiful, beautiful, so historic, learning the history behind the Haitian people. So please read up on the Citadel in Cap Haitian, Haiti.
And very briefly, one of you, where can our listeners find your stories?
Lots of different places. The New Pittsburgh Courier, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Jermaine has a website. We have a travel website, Diaspora Cultural Tours on Facebook. Mm-hmm. They can find more information there as well.
And I understand the Haiti Times and Miami Herald
as
well.
Yes, that's exactly right. One of our reporters on this recent trip is doing a number of pieces for that publication.
Well, next month will mark the 9th anniversary of that massive earthquake that hit Haiti. But certainly, we thank you for the storytelling. Jermaine Watkins is a photographer, teacher, and artist with the Manchester Craftsman's Guild. Allegra Johnson is a freelance journalist and communications manager for Propel Schools. And Dr. Irvin Dyer is senior editor at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks for all for being here and for telling us the stories.
Thank you
for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on our program, we meet Teron Jenkins. He's a former public defender, a private defense attorney. So why does he want to go to the other side? He's challenging longtime district attorney Stephen Zapala. He says the best way to change the criminal justice system is from within. Plus, another installment of the WESA series, Still Working, Gig Jobs. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, with production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.